This is Coda Radio, episode 186 for January 4th, 2016. Welcome to Coda Radio, Jupiter Broadcasting's weekly talk show, taking a pragmatic look at the art and business of software development and related technologies. This episode is brought to you by our two fine sponsors, DigitalOcean and Linux Academy. I'll tell you more about those great sponsors as this year's show goes on. My name is Chris, and joining us every single week, like a robot, maybe a droid you might say, posted at his duty spot for thousands of years. Why, yes, folks, it's Mr. Michael Dominic. Hello, Michael.
You will be exterminated.
Your command. What is it? Your desire is my command. Something I am a robot. This is your podcast. You know, Mr. Dominic, I got droids on the brain. Went and saw the Star Wars podcast. Not going to say anything more. Just went and saw it. Went and saw the Star Wars podcast. Jeez. Movie. Went and saw the Star Wars movie. Do you know they make movies, Mr. Dominic? The Disney Corporation.
The Disney Corporation makes many things.
Yes, they do. Hey, how was your holidays? Did you have some good holidays?
Yeah, I don't remember. Oh, yeah. New Year's?
Good.
I stayed home. I didn't do anything.
You know, that's prudent. That's prudent because you got the police officers out on the road and they will give you tickets. So you never know. You never know. I went all about, did all kinds of things, did some podcasts, did things like that. But you know what struck me, Mr. Dominic, as we approach now to 2016? We have many things to discuss today.
Yes.
In fact, we have an app apocalypse to discuss that is sort of revisiting a topic that I think we have not had the final word on. But after all of that, Mike had a chance to cover something that in his blog that we completely forgot to discuss in last week's episode of the Coda Radio program. So we're going to do a make good on that. And then I think we're going to change our tune on something that some people think maybe we've gotten completely wrong on this show. I'm not sure. I was listening to I was reading the podcast before we started.
You know, and Chris, it is extremely courageous and brave for you to finally be sharing this publicly.
Thank you for acknowledging that because this is hard for me.
You might be ridiculed. You know, you might be called a hypocrite. This could be a very risky thing for you.
Then I'm going to get your opinion on Android going to OpenJDK, and we have a massive link dump from Chaotic Linux that's going to help you get smarter. So I was just talking with Mike before the show got started and about a couple of weeks out, the episode that airs on the 25th of a Monday over at the jblive.tv. And because the Coda Radio show is live. Hey, newsflash, everybody. Did you know that? Did you know that the Coda Radio program is live?
He's a jackass.
What? Get him out of here. So next week we'll be here, and the week after that we'll be here. It's going to be regular old show for a bit, but on the 25th, I'm going to be on the road, if all goes as planned, to head to Scale 14. Are you going to be at Scale, Mike? Are you,
No, I should have been at CES, but, you know, pregnant wife, work.
Yeah. You know, boy, do I know that one. I remember, you know what? Three kids. I'm just saying. Let me tell you, that is a thing. That is a hard thing. And now Noah's going through that, too, for the third time.
Oh,
anyways, so I'm going to be on the road. We're going to have a special guest host on the week of the 25th. That's all I'm saying right now. But we're going to have a special guest host. I'll be stepping out while I'm on the road, and Mike will be joined by a very special guest host. So you guys can all stay tuned.
Can't we just tell them it's Satya Nadella?
Mike, we got to build the hype. And I'm still ordering the ice bucket. I haven't got the ice bucket in yet.
Because he needs the smoke and the red carpet as he walks in.
No, the ice bucket challenge. Remember Satya did the ice bucket challenge?
I was like, what is he getting at? Like a dramatic video entry? Or?
Yeah, no, it's in his runner. He has to have steam in the room when he sits down to host a podcast.
Laser.
Everybody knows that, yeah. Yeah, I've got one of those Christmas holiday laser projectors in the corner, and then I got an ice bucket with a fan.
You know who I'd rather have? I'd rather have, like, Bomber, but, like, when they black out the victim's name on America, whatever that show is.
With the voice changer, so you don't know it's Steve Bomber.
But it was just like, developer, developer, developer.
I think our audience would be too smart. I think they would know. I think they would know that was Steve Ballmer.
Well, once you started sweating through the blackout thing, it would really...
Oh, jeez, that's good. Oh,
I don't know why I went for that, but...
Yeah, it's a cheap shot, but it's a good reference. If anybody's seen the Ballmer in public. Wow. Well, see, this is why you got to come to scale. You don't even have to have a talk. You could have a stand-up comedy routine where you just rail on Ballmer. I think it'd be a big hit with that crowd.
Now, so the reason I don't go to conferences, by the way, is you're not allowed to make fun of the people paying for the conference there.
Oh, yeah, sure. Sure.
For those of us who don't know, what is Scale?
Scale is the Southern California Linux Expo. It's been going on for 14 years, and it's sort of become just because everybody decided the big Linux event. This is the one that
bigger
is...
Bigger than Northwest?
Yeah. And here's the other thing about it, and I haven't been to one yet because... Northwest has really been my bread and butter, and it's right here in my backyard, and it's a great event. Scale, though, it promises to also be a great event, and so there's a huge difference in the Linux world between expos and cons. And so Scale is an expo, right? Or it's like a community event. It's a fest. Whereas cons, LinuxCon, OSCon, these are more commercial. These are more big budget, enterprise. People are there that know Linux, they know Docker, and they know scaling, or, you know, they don't get these bullet point words, but they don't actually know any of the community. They wouldn't know who Ian Murdoch is. They wouldn't know what the app-get package manager is, right?
They're commercial, basically.
Promises to be the biggest of the community fest, like big enough to almost be an industry trade event, small enough to be still a community fest. And to sort of mark the occasion, Canonical is relaunching their in-person UbaCons. So they went to the online Ubuntu developer summits where they all did them through Hangouts with horrible audio.
Yeah, that was not a good idea.
Woo! Yeah, so now they're going back to doing summits. And
awesome.
They're doing their first one here, right, a big one that overlaps with Scale at Scale. So it's going to be like a concurrent track at Scale. You could go to UbaCon at Scale. So once Canonical decided to do that, too, I knew I had to go. I couldn't ignore Scale anymore. So, and I've been doing it for a long time because Linux Fest is awesome, but I got to get to, now I got to do both.
It's relatively local for you. Is that what, a 4 or 5 hour drive?
It's about a 19 hour drive, but when you're pulling or driving an RV, you got to add a lot more to that. So it's going to be about a 2 day drive for me.
Okay. Wow. Yeah.
No, a 2 day drive isn't too bad. If you're a road tripper, that's not so bad because, you know, you make the best of it. Like, I'm thinking about taking Highway 101, which literally runs along the coast of Washington, the coast of Oregon, and the coast of California, and then jumping over. I mean, it's like...
Just take it all the way down.
The entire way is ocean view. It's, you know, small little diners all along. It's just gorgeous. So, I mean, it's a great drive. I'm looking forward to it, actually. But here's the thing, is Linux Fest Northwest was like what we go all in on, and we still want to go all in on. So we are asking the audience to help us fund Scale by bringing back the limited run of the Linux Action Show shirts, hoodies, ladies tee, and t-shirt. You can go to teespring.com/last400, and if you're in the EU, it's last400EU, and they have a tote bag too. You could actually order the tote bag in the US, which I might do, actually. Anyways, so we're bringing these back, and I'm asking if you are in a position to buy one or two or even three. We've only sold 15, and I need to sell a lot more than that. I mean, we need to raise several thousand dollars, if possible, to help fund all of this, because we really want to be able to do this without having to break the bank and have to pull back on our coverage in other places. So we would love your support. Plus, you get some great swag. I love these shirts. I have one.
I have a black one, actually.
Yeah, I have all of them because they are really good. And I pay for them. I don't get them for free. I buy them, too. So teespring.com/last400. We sold 15. Ideally, too, by the way, if you're going to make it to Scale, these should ship in time for you to get them. Also, we have a promo code.
To the conference.
Yeah, and then we'll know you. Last 40. If you want to get a ticket at Scale, last 40, you get 40% off. I don't know what admission is, but you get 40% off whatever it is.
So, yeah, it's funny. This is not what we're going to talk about today, but the conference thing. Before I knew about the baby coming, I had a plan, Chris. I had a roadmap. I had a calendar of conferences I was going to this year. Yeah, I definitely can't go to two of them.
The tough part there, too, is like it's really hard to gauge the impact on business because since it's never any – you know, what's funny, Mike, is like I have gone to events that were just a massive, massive amount of commitment, you know, had to do a bunch of coordination, train rides, all this kind of stuff. And I walked away and I went, I don't know if that was really worth it. And then a year later, a contact I made, actually two contacts I made, totally just like came through and paid off. And I was like, wow, if I hadn't gone and shook those hands and exchanged those cards, and not only that, but I also just met people that now when I go back and see again, like it's a continuing relationship that we're building. And like now I feel comfortable, like, you know, I can email Karen Sandler at the Software Conservancy and be like, hey, Karen, I was wondering. And like, because, you know, I've talked to her five times now in person, like I just am comfortable doing that now. And so there is a value that it's really, really hard to put a number on because, you know, it's a very fluid, dynamic thing when you go to these kind of a conference or events. Yeah. Or fests.
I mean, something I struggle with is basically all the big ones are in California with like two exceptions. So, you know, if you think about it coming from the East Coast, that's a trip. And it also, and I wonder how you feel about this. You know, Apple and Google now do like lottery systems for Google I/O.
For their developer events, yeah.
Right, which is awful. That means you need to, that means you need to wait to see if you got a ticket and then book the hotels once they've already been
Sold out. Right, because, and let's be real here. The thing is if you're an individual dude or dudette or small company, you're going up against massive dev shops that are comfortable preemptively buying tickets, preemptively buying rooms. They're comfortable like gambling that somebody or a large amount of somebody's are going to get those tickets. So they go ahead and buy all that stuff up.
Right. And well, and in the worst case, right, they don't get a ticket to the conference. They just send a sales guy and he hangs out at the bars. Really. I remember I tallied up what DubDub would have cost last year and it was like $5,000 or $6,000. It was crazy.
Yeah. And I would say that's pretty fair. Are you including air flight and hotel?
Well, I was going to get the air flight comped. So that's a good point. Yeah. But it would have been more.
Yeah. So for me, it is an interesting. So one of the things I'm trying to do with the rover is I'm trying to be able to work
anywhere.
So that way I don't have to also take the hit. Because what I can't do is I can't square the cost of going to the event with the cost of also losing out on productivity.
Right.
It's just too high. So the idea was get a mobile office, or in my case, a mobile studio, right? And I'm not the first person to come up with this. And to a degree, I think it worked pretty successfully. I think if you know, now I'm not saying you should do this, but I think, you know, somebody in your position could do a lot of their job from an RV or a trailer while you're on a trip. But the problem is for you, that means coming from the East Coast all the way to California. Now, for me, it means a two-day trip. Yeah, for you, it would be a two-week trip.
It seems a lot less feasible. What I have found, if you're going to fly somewhere and you need to effectively work, like Continental and American Airlines, if you're willing to spend more money, have it's for either first class or just below first class, you can get basically enough to set yourself up with an office. The problem there is you're spending about $1,000 on a plane ticket.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure.
So, you know, short flights, let's say New Jersey or Florida to either each other or, you know, even the Midwest, it probably makes more sense just to fly coach and, you know, read a book.
Right.
But
or listen to a podcast. Hello.
Yeah. Listen to a podcast. Oh, of course.
Right.
But, you know, like New York to California or New Jersey to California, that's a trip and a half. That's about 5 hours.
Yeah.
It's a whole day.
Yeah. It's a big factor. And it's so funny that this is a topic you and I have been discussing is like, boy, what's the value to the business? And what's the value of those connections? And how long does it take? And how many times do you have to keep going before you even start to notice a payoff? And how do you continue to justify that when life events like pregnancy and birthdays come up and business events like client demands come up and staff issues. It is really an interesting and complicated aspect of business that you don't even really get yourself into until you realize, oh, the next echelon for growth is me doing this. And this takes a whole new level of commitment that I never even fathomed.
Right. Well, then there's the whole aspect of like good conferences and bad conferences, right? I mean, why don't we just go into this a little bit? I found there's like three or four different types of tech conferences. There's, you know, the big, big ones, right? Which just sounds like is effectively what you're going to. Community driven, but huge. Those are usually pretty good. But have you ever been to like the vendor driven one? Like,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. I won't say names, but I've been to a couple of those. And it's a sea of salespeople, which if your purpose to go to this conference was to grow business, you're not talking to anyone who can, you know, be useful in that capacity, right? Then there's, of course, I mean, I am going to something next week locally at Bell Labs, or what used to be Bell Labs. But you even, you know, even those little local ones, sometimes you actually meet people that are, you know, in the field with you. Sometimes you meet a bunch of random salespeople who just go to every conference for everything. And I don't know how to solve that. I guess I would say I don't know how to qualify a conference as worth going to or not, other than the obvious ones like Google I.O., WWDC.
Right.
You know, right. The ones that are so clearly for you.
Isn't it interesting the ones that you list as clearly for you are ones that are essentially vendor-run. They're just vendor-run correctly for platforms that are just extremely relevant.
They're vendor-run, but the vendor's not competing with what I'm doing.
Right. Oh, okay.
So let's say like an IBM conference might be a little scary for me because why would anyone buy consulting from me?
Right, when they could get IBM.
Yeah. 400 IBM salesmen standing there.
Ooh, that just gives me chills right there. It gives me chills when you say it.
No, I will give credit to Oracle. They're usually not – I've been to like two or three of their smaller events locally. They're not awful with that. They'll – you know, it seems like they go out of their way not to overshadow, you know, small ISVs where IBM, my experience, is just like, yeah, we sell consulting. That's what we do.
Right. Right. Yeah. I want to talk about this is interesting. We're talking about this now because people are going to be looking at this in 2016 as they look out at the year and events that are coming up. Something else that I want to talk about today is I don't mean to overstate this, but who just said it in the chat room? Arch Uber Valley just suggested as a title, One Language to Rule. Now, we've always talked about one language to rule them all, you know, all this kind of stuff that is never going to be the case because there's so many edge cases. There's so many specific reasons why one language couldn't rule them all. But is it possible that one language could get really damn close and rule 90%? Could one language maybe come close to ruling it all?
Are you talking?
Don't say it. Don't say it. Don't say it. Because before we get to that, I think we ought to talk about the app apocalypse.
Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, yes. And this is an article over on Ars Technica, and they say it's going to have to go to web standards. There's currently a whole litany of problems with apps. The platform lock-in, of course. Updating apps is a pain, and users often ignore it, leaving broken, vulnerable versions long after they've been patched. Apps are also always a lot of work for developers. It's not fairly easy to write apps that are native on both iOS and Android, let alone Windows and BlackBerry. So the alternative? Well, crap. Use a web browser. That's right. Use the web browser. Updates to HTML apps happen entirely on the server, so users get them immediately. There's no window of vulnerability between release of a security fix and the user applying the update. So with a capable HTML-based platform and a well-designed program, it makes good use of CSS. Problem solved. Currently, standards are advancing rapidly in the area of mobile web applications as part of the emerging HTML5 platform. The goal, backed strongly by Google and Mozilla, is for websites to be able to do anything that a native app can. If this happens, native apps may no longer be necessary or even desirable. Standard bodies have been hard at work developing interfaces to control graphics, device notifications, data storage, payments, GPS, compass, accelerometer, and other sensors, forms, multimedia, and more. And the W3C maintains a roadmap of these standard efforts developed and even recently completed. Among the efforts jumpstarted by the HTML5 apps was the future W3C Web Payments API standard that would define how web applications interact with mobile wallets and other payment systems. Obviously, web applications don't work when there's no network to connect to. A middle ground application called Hybrid addresses this, but at a cost. Now, this is the part I'm curious to get your input on. Hybrid apps use native operating system web browser controls to open full screen windows, but they look and behave like native apps, including requiring a download from an app store. Hybrid apps get access to the hardware features unavailable through the web through third-party tools, mostly based on Apache Cordova. Hardware supporting Cordova for iOS and Android is excellent, but spotty elsewhere. So, web standards, and you fill the gap with Cordova, and maybe I'll just wrap it up before you jump in. He links to a few things that are in progress, like initiatives for web VR and other things. Your thoughts, yeah. Mr. Dominic?
So, I mean, obviously, you know, I have a big investment in the hybrid app space, right? I think that's the most reasonable solution for the problem we're facing. But I would caution that with a few things. One, people who've done Cordova, what we're talking about with modern hybrid apps are a lot better and a little more, let's just say, performant than straight Cordova apps. So are you saying
it's not your grandpa's a hybrid app?
It is not your grandpa's phone gap, basically. It's not
yeah, exactly.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
But, you know, just there's a couple things, right? The idea that native apps are going to die is a little silly. I mean, one, Apple and Google have an interest, particularly Apple, right, in making native apps as good as possible. Apple really wants to differentiate from Android. And there's just some experiences that you're better off delivering through a native app for a specific platform.
That's true. I mean, do you really feel like they've hobbled Safari very much? I mean, they've in the past, they made the faster JavaScript engine not available to standalone web apps. But Safari itself has sort of been fairly aggressive until Chrome Mobile really stepped in at pushing.
You know, yeah, with iOS 8 and iOS 9, they've actually been fairly cooperative with hybrid applications.
I mean, I feel like they definitely improved it with 7 and 8. But even before then, they were some of the first to implement like the accelerometer and touchscreen stuff in their mobile web browser before anybody else had it. I mean, they've been really... I mean, at what point have they really hobbled Safari?
Well, not at all, right? Their initial strategy was everybody would do HTML5 apps.
Right, exactly.
But I just want to walk it back a little bit, because the author of this article has set up basically three different app development strategies. Totally server-side, let's just call them mobile responsive apps, right? Even though that's a simplification, where you're literally pinning a web page to someone's phone for them. Historically, I can tell you lots of normal users don't know that they can do that, but there is a place for that, and that place is called the enterprise, mm-hmm. where the company is paying for the phones, and you preload that onto the person's home screen.
Or even a moderately advanced user who wants to have like something hosted up on DigitalOcean or something, and they want to have their own admin panel pinned to their screen.
You know, you're accepting a lot more limitations that way in terms of performance and access to features on the device than you even have with a hybrid application. There are pure native applications, right? Which I am working on, literally before the show today, I am working on a purely native Android application. They have lots of places where they make sense. Let me just name three real fast.
Okay.
You're going for a consumer market where you have competitors, and this is something you want people to pay for. Native is probably going to give you a little more flash, a little more flurry than you would have otherwise. You are a small to medium business, and you're simply, again, buying devices for your employees, and you know I'm only going to buy iPhones. Well, maybe just going native makes more sense. The other case is a little more fuzzy. It's, you know, if you're in a very competitive market, there is a small tax with hybrid apps, and a much bigger tax with those, let's just call them mobile responsive apps, in dealing with new APIs. Let me give you an example where Ionic and Cordova might catch up with an API in a couple months. And to be fair, they do a really good job. They may even get you ready to go during the beta at some point. You know, if you're a native developer, you can, as soon as the beta is released, you can just download it, throw it on a device, and be good to go. And I can think of some cases where that makes a lot of sense. Let's say you're integrating with other hardware, right? You're in the fitness or health and wellness space. Probably native is going to give you some bang for your buck. So
I also, so that is from the development-centric standpoint, but if I look at it from a corporate standpoint, how much of it is, well, this is what our in-house tool chain is. Our in-house tool chain is to develop web applications. We want to make web applications for our clients, et cetera, et cetera. So we make web apps. Doesn't really matter what's native or not. And how much, which we're going to talk about in a little bit, is, well, say we start developing Swift for the front end and the back end, and now when we bring in new devices into the enterprise, we've written our apps in Swift, and so we're just doing native apps because we're writing it all in Swift anyways, which could also be a possibility. What I'm trying to say is sometimes it's not even a matter of performance or look. Sometimes it literally comes down to, well, this is the house's tool chain, and this is how we do things.
Well, I would say a couple of things. One, a lot of people I talk to and a lot of our customers basically, right, are those type of enterprises that think, you know, maybe one day we'll take this in-house and, you know, we won't have to pay you a service fee, basically, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, that almost immediately excludes native. But I would caution people. Yes, you know, W3C, the standards bodies, the open source developers for these web technologies, and frankly, Google and Apple, who are doing a lot of this stuff behind the scenes, right, are doing a really good job of implementing a lot of interesting stuff just straight through the web page with those mobile responsive apps. But you're probably not getting a good return on that. You're probably better off either dealing with the learning curve of going hybrid or just paying a shop and going hybrid. Because at the end of the day, what really matters is how solid is the end result, right? How does it feel on the phone? Even if it's an internal application, you want it to not be slow, because if all your employees are using it and it takes, you know, a minute to load, you have some serious problems. Or, I mean, Chris, we've been doing this for a long time. It may seem like a great cost-cutting move right now, right? But cutting yourself off from integrating with the device itself, probably not the way to go if you plan to support the software long-term.
Especially because the competitive market dictates that these vendors keep busting out great new features that are going to require platform updates that is going to be, you know, that's where the money's going to be made when the margins are thin and apps are a dime a dozen. The apps that can jump on those new platform or hardware features are the ones that make the monies.
Right. Well, see, when you're looking at an enterprise space, so it's more about maintenance.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just saying that's why it's very much a matter of what is your plan? What is your – because if it's the tool chain and it's this what the house uses, then that kind of platform stuff, that platform lag, you know, that doesn't affect you. That doesn't matter to you as much because, honestly, you're probably not even updating all the devices when the new OS comes out and the new features are available anyways.
Yeah, I mean, so the way I tend to present it to potential clients is it's a scale. Think of it like a treadmill, right? You can go fully native. You're giving up cross-platform, and you're doubling your costs, and you're running as fast as you can possibly go, and you're right on the tails of Apple and Google. It makes sense if you have high performance, or you need a lot of, you know, you plan to update to iOS 10 when it comes out, and you want every new feature, or you're doing something really intensive, processing intensive. There are very few and far people that I deal with that really need that. But on the other side of the spectrum, I really can't recommend against the other extreme more, because it seems like a good idea. It seems like you're going to save, with the other extreme being just hosting it on a server and pinning it to the homepage. You think you're going to save money, but every time I've had someone do this, like pass up on having us develop a hybrid app, and we have an HTML developer here, you know, he's going to do it and we'll be fine. 3 months, 6 months later, I get a call back. Yeah, it's running slow and it doesn't look very good and my employees are complaining. And we want to do this stuff with a camera and it doesn't work and we need to, whatever it is, right? They saved a little bit of money, you know, a quarter before. And they've only, but they're going to end up spending it anyway, and they wasted their employees' time because by not at least going hybrid, they're boxing themselves in to the browser. And really, you know, Apple and Google just don't have an interest in making that a great experience.
Yeah, and it just adds more complication, you know, and it essentially creates a runtime that you're now sort of behest of what changes they make.
Yeah. Ultimately,
get the hell out of here.
Get out of here. You know, ultimately, I think if you want to be developing a mobile piece of software for your employees or for anyone, you kind of want some sort of application management infrastructure, and you probably want it to be expandable for the future. And you may not know what that future is, so don't box yourself in.
Well put, Mr. Dominic. You know what else I'd like to say is something that's out of the box. That's DigitalOcean. First sponsor here on the Coder Radio program this week, DigitalOcean is simple cloud hosting, and you can use the promo code CoderDigital, CoderDigital, one word lowercase, to get a $10 credit. Now, here's the thing. Their rig starts at $5 a month. They'll get you 512 megabytes of RAM, a 20 gigabyte SSD, one CPU, and a terabyte of transfer. You can get started in less than 55 seconds when you go to spin up your DigitalOcean rig, which, if you think about that, less than 55 seconds is probably almost half the time it takes for most virtualization programs, management programs, to even launch on your desktop. This is one of the best interfaces out there, folks. I mean, it's really good. And it's not just good for a website. It's good for all kind of virtualization management applications I have ever seen. It is a simple intuitive control panel that is yet extremely powerful. You can get an idea by watching the animation they have on their site, or go over and look at the features page of DigitalOcean. Go to DigitalOcean.com and just get an idea of some of the things you can do. So they've got a new floating IPs feature, which is really great. I encourage you to go read about that. Support for team accounts and a very versatile API. All of that, plus an amazing interface that makes it crazy easy to deploy one application or an entire stack. You can go from like an Ubuntu LTS rig with just a base Ubuntu LTS rig, or you can deploy the entire stack, the LTS machine, the Apache, MySQL, PHP, or Nginx, the entire stack. They have Fedora, CentOS, CoreOS, Debian, of course, and FreeBSD available. One-click application deployments are great. Just use the promo code CODERDIGITAL and get the $10 credit and try something. I've got BitTorrent Sync, SyncThing, OwnCloud, Minecraft, QuazzleCore, Mumble. What else? Oh, MB. I feel like I'm forgetting something else. A Stun Server. I got all kinds of things I'm running up on DigitalOcean all the time. The value is amazing. And it's a really good service. The entire infrastructure runs on Linux. They have data centers all over the world, like New York, San Francisco, Singapore, Amsterdam, London, Germany, Toronto. I mean, they've really got it dialed in. DigitalOcean.com. Use the promo code CODERDIGITAL. You can use them as your back-end infrastructure. You can use them for testing, for learning. It's really great. DigitalOcean.com. Just use the promo code CODERDIGITAL. Supports this show, keeps us going, and gives you a $10 credit. DigitalOcean.com. And a big thank you to DigitalOcean for sponsoring the Coder Radio program. Thank you, DigitalOcean. Thank you very much.
Just stroke it a little bit.
All right. So, Mr. Dominic, I was looking at a blog post you made over at the Buccaneer.io. You know, have you heard of Buccaneer.io? This is a website.
Yar.
Yeah, it's a website you've got. And you did a, like every great developer I know, a 2015 year in review on January 3rd, 2016. Well done, sir. Well done. I like that. That's nice.
Hey, man, I got those SEOs, and what do you want from me?
There's some things that jumped out at me here in this. Here's what you wrote. I'm just going to read a little bit of this, and I want to talk about it with you. Containerization has gained a lot more traction in 2015, and Docker has some serious competition in the space of CoreOS's Rocket. We've seen a lot of success using Doku, a Docker-powered open source pass in a box, you know, as a platform as a service in a box that allows us to deploy our own pass platform complete with Git-powered deployment capabilities. Back in my day, we would never have acronyms that long. You also talk about Swift for a bit. I want to hold the Swift talk because I want to talk about Docker just for a moment on the show, because this is something that we really should have talked about. This is our make good. We should have talked about this last week. And before we go any further, the thing is, we talked about this a lot in episode 379 of the Linux Action Show, too. We went to LinuxCon, which was actually DockerCon, and it was all about Docker. And so as we are sitting here on a January 1st, 2016, it is hard to appreciate how big of a deal Docker was in 2015. Even covering it in Coder Radio, Linux Action Show, Linux Unplugged, and TechSnap, that's the shows that we sometimes talk about Docker in. Alan Jude loves Docker. Let me tell you, covering it even in all of those shows, I still didn't really appreciate what a big deal it was until I went to DockerCon, and it was, oh, these are multi-million-dollar companies, you know, like SAP, SAP, and these are really huge companies that are developing massive projects around Docker and containerization and managing those containers. And it was obvious to me that this was containerization was going to change Linux server hosting forever. And there's nobody can talk enough about Docker. Ironically, we didn't talk at all about Docker last week. So I was kind of curious to pick your brain about what 2015.
Yeah, you know, really, because Docker just became a fact of life for me, I think.
Yeah.
Like, oh, we're doing a deployment. Okay, so it's in Docker. Great. Bye.
Yeah.
Like, to the point of, I've never. Just in general, right? We've never seen a technology explode on the scene and get such a rapid adoption in what is a fairly conservative space, the whole deployment server.
Servers, yes, exactly. Yeah.
I'm pretty happy with it. So what are your thoughts on Docker from 2015?
It became Kleenex of containerization, for one. It became the TiVo of PVRs. And I think it definitely peaked. Oh, I almost hate to say it. But I think the concept of containers is pretty damn solid. And I think what you're going to have are systems that run multiple types of containers. And Docker is going to be one more. Docker is going to be the most popular. Docker is going to be the standard for developing and delivering software. It's even going to be a way, I think, more and more for enterprises to demo software. So you go buy like an enterprise-grade piece of software, but before you buy it, they're going to give you a Docker container that you'll check out, and that'll be how you demo it. That's going to be like the sort of like the backbone of the container ecosystem, if you will. However, I think a lot of folks like Buccaneer and a lot of internal IT shops and dev shops will just use different types of containers. I don't think it's necessarily all going to be Docker brand containers. I think it's going to be some of the Canonical stuff. Rockets out there. You obviously have FreeBSD jails. I think what it was containers were proven, and now 2016 is going to be sort of the refinement of, well, which one is the best for your situation, and which container implementation fits you best, and it's not always going to be Docker is the answer to that. Does that seem sensical to you?
Yeah, I think containerization as a concept is going to catch on pretty strong, and it already has, right, in 2015. That was my whole point in that post. I kind of have a different view of it. I think containerization is going to become an underlying technology, and we're going to have additional things built on top of it. For instance, the Doku project that I'm very heavily using, which lets you use some of the power of Docker and containerization to effectively create a much less expensive Heroku in a box.
That's how DigitalOcean does a lot of their one-click deployments.
Yep. One thing that's interesting is whenever we talk about containerization, you start thinking about the client side. And that's an area where I haven't really invested in containerization. But I could certainly see a world where, your app is delivered, especially in Linux, right, where you have dependencies to worry about, a little more than you might, let's say, in OS X, is delivered on a container, and you send the whole damn container to the client or to the customer.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It's happening now, but I think it's just going to become the standard in 2016.
Yeah, I think it's pretty uncommon. I've heard of people doing it. I don't know that it's, one big problem, a lot of the platforms I focus on, it really wouldn't make sense for. But certainly, all of our Linux deployments are using some sort of containerization, and it's almost always Docker.
Yeah, and I think Docker is going to just have to, it's got the momentum, it's got the mindshare. It's just going to, I don't see how anything on the Linux side will be more popular than Docker. At this point, they nailed it, and they got Red Hat to buy off, which was huge in 2015. They got Red Hat to ship Red Hat 7 with Docker 1.0. I believe that they preemptively labeled it Docker 1.0 just so that way Red Hat felt justified in shipping it in Red Hat Enterprise 7. But that shows you how serious they were. And then LinuxCon, which is run and put on by the Linux Foundation themselves, decided to call it DockerCon.
Well, if you think about it, they have both the Red Hat and Canonical buying in, which is huge.
Yeah. All right, Mr. Dominic. Well, so we've been teasing it all episode. There's something that we've both been waiting to talk about. I got to have maybe a little mea culpa on this. Well, Mr. Dominic's the one that almost unanimously had to cancel the show, middle of the show, after he heard the news. But the reality is, here we are in 2016, and things look a little different. But first, I got to thank Linux Academy. And you could, too, by going to linuxacademy.com/coders. Thank them for supporting the show for so dang long and coming into 2016 with us. And get the Coder Radio discount. Linux Academy is a training platform for you. It's built by people that genuinely know this stuff and are passionate about it, so they make good content. But not only that, they follow the trends like Docker and containerization. They make sure that they have the best material on it. They have instructor help available on demand. They have over 2,000 videos, downloadable comprehensive study guides, 7+ distros that you get to choose from, and the courseware automatically adjusts to those distros. And so do the lab servers that you get to SSH into to do your work. They have graded server exercises. You get your work evaluated while connected to a real server. Isn't that nice? While you log into a lab server and perform a specific task, Linux Academy automatically grades your actions so you can see how well you did. And it's just part of the Linux Academy membership. LinuxAcademy.com/coders. Go learn anytime with availability planners to make sure courseware that matches your busy schedule, and nuggets so you can do deep dive into specific topics when you have time, and then full-on coursewares that breaks down the major topics that you've been hearing about or need to learn into hours and bite-sized chunks that you can actually understand. I've told this story often, but looking at Python and Ruby and their courseware on Linux Academy, I was able to make the transition from, there's this thing out there called Python, and I would like to learn it, but I don't know really what that would entail. And it went from that to, when I have 5 hours, I can learn Python. That is really empowering. And that can make you a better worker. That can make you a better employee. That makes you make you look better on a review. That may help you land a better client. There's a lot of reasons you might be motivated to go to Linux Academy. So I want you to go to linuxacademy.com/coders. They also have the whole Amazon Web Services stack. If you're getting into DevOps, they've got great courseware on you. OpenStack is their bread and butter. And they've even got courseware on PHP. Of course, they've got the Linux basics too, with in-depth resources, instructor help available when you need it, and a community stacked full of Jupiter Broadcasting members. LinuxAcademy.com/coders. It is a great investment in yourself, and visiting that website supports the show. LinuxAcademy.com/coders. And a big thank you to Linux Academy for sponsoring the Coder Radio program. And congratulations, with over 2,029 videos. That is damn impressive. I know what it takes to make that. And that stuff, you know, is the kind of thing they're doing is much harder than what we do. LinuxAcademy.com/coders. Big thank you to Linux Academy for sponsoring the Coder Radio program. And thank you to our audience for visiting that link so they know that you heard about it here and you appreciate them keeping us going. Okay, Mike. So, I mean, there's no other way to put it. They went open source in December, and it's already gone nuts. Swift is going to be big in 2016, but I think it might be big for you personally, even though you've been doing Android development recently. What do you think?
Well, one, not just doing Android development, just on that. But, yes, so...
That's true. I mean, you've been talking about Android development recently.
That's true. I've had a... Well, let's call it a swift change of heart.
Oh, now, hold on. For those of you who haven't been listening for a while, we were doing our WWDC commentary live one episode.
Oh, it was bad.
Maybe we should do that again, because there's nothing like Mike was so pissed after Swift was announced that we basically had to wrap the show.
I was deeply unhappy.
Yeah. We should do it live again this year. This was so good. Okay. All right. Anyway, so when you say you've had a swift change of heart, what you mean is a complete and 180-degree change of position.
I mean, like every good politician, I just change sides.
Okay, continue, sir.
Well, so two things, right? One, if you really want to have another fun live show, we have to do Google I/O because I have a feeling it's going to be that.
You're right. That would be good. You know,
Apple's much more conservative now. I don't think.
Yeah, you're right. Google I/O is probably more of a party, but Google I/O is so long. We'd have to cut it off at a certain point.
We'd have to have like Red Bull ready to go. Chris, I just don't care about this new CSS tech.
I feel like a Google I/O episode, if we cover the entire event, would be epic, but also it would like completely exceed some people's bandwidth caps for the month.
Have to do it on video too, just watching our faces fall.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
For exhaustion. All right, so Swift. You know, Swift has changed since it was originally announced, right? Swift 2.0 has definitely gotten a lot more mature. The tooling has gotten a lot better. For instance, Xcode doesn't vomit every time you open a Swift project. Mm. That's a feature, though Xcode does frequently vomit anyway. There is a lot of advantage in using Swift in certain situations.
And legitimately, they delivered the goods.
Basically, right? They fixed everything that was buggy or incomplete about it. Now, not that it's perfect, and not that it couldn't, you know, they shouldn't keep iterating on it, which they are, by the way. You can just look at it on GitHub if you want to know where they're going. One of the biggest areas that Swift still isn't quite there for me yet is integrating, adding Swift to an existing Objective-C project. My point, though, is going forward, I think starting an iOS project that's native and not using Swift is a little silly, right? Because you're skating to where the puck was. The signaling from Apple is pretty clear that they'll support Objective-C, but Objective-C is a redheaded second son who came home from school with a frog in his pants. Swift, actually, Objective-C is more like the creepy uncle living in the attic.
He's still around, and every now and then he's guy you got to go to ask a question about something in the family.
Yeah, like, hey, Uncle C, what's up, man?
Just call him Uncle C or Uncle Ob. Or Uncle Scott. It could be Uncle Scott Forster or whatever his name was. Forstall.
Poor Forstall. God, you can't catch a break. There is value in Swift. Now, the value is basically speed of development and speed of, not compilation, what's the word I'm looking for? Process speed. And honestly, you kind of want to go where Apple's going. You don't want to be hanging on to your life vest. You know, it's been a year, right? If Swift was going to go away, it would have already went away. Let's not even talk about Cocoa Java. You know, Apple usually doesn't let things go for this long, throw so much marketing behind them, and then kill them, right?
Oh, yeah, also, it's not going anywhere. This is a long-term thing.
Also, it's now open source, which really, and I wonder if I didn't convey this well in the article, really is a huge advantage. And probably more important even than the fact that Objective-C is probably going to get marginalized over the next 5 to 6 years. It's not just Apple deciding what's good for this language anymore. It's the whole open source community that's interested. It's the potential for Swift on the back end and having a full stack Swift deployment, which right now, crazy, but in a year or 2 years, there may be a reason to do it.
I'm astonished at the adoption I've seen in the open source community. I today, before the show, because I figured we'd be talking about this a little bit, did some casual Googling, and I saw dozens and dozens of Linux-only projects that are integrating, like, they're creating Swift libraries. One of them was like the Bluetooth stack, the Blue Z stack for Linux. There is now a Swift library, so you can just call to that for a Linux. And the idea, what they're creating are Linux powered iBeacons, where people can write Swift applications and have like little Raspberry Pi iBeacons. You know, Apple's location technology. So these are going to be like brew your own iBeacons running Linux, with the software for it written in Swift, running on Linux. And these are already open source projects that are well underway. And it's kind of genius, actually, because iBeacon is a pretty solid technology. And if you could have open source code using an open source programming language running on an open source operating system, that's one of the more viably trustable beacon platforms out there.
Yep.
And ironically, it'd be Apple's. And so when I was looking into this, it seems to be there is already quite a bit of momentum and adoption just on the Linux side alone, which in Linux Action Show this Sunday, I said is going to become the uncomfortable reality by the end of 2016 for a lot of Linux users.
Well, I think the biggest strength it has is, again, being open source. I think it's going to be a serious player on the field just for general languages. Not even, general languages for iOS, general languages for OS X. It's going to be, I hate to throw some mud the Ubuntu way, but a Swift with some sort of UI toolkit, as the person in the chat room is mentioning, and I'm going to steal this from him now, but make it more negative so he didn't say this, with some sort of integration to GNOME or some other UI toolkit, would be a much stronger development platform than what Canonical is currently offering.
Well, hold on there. Just give it a pause. Yeah, that does make a lot of sense. Hold on, you just kind of went roboto. So I'm going to hang up on you and call you right back because I don't know what happened.
He doesn't love me anymore.
Oh, actually, you sound okay now. Sound okay. Boom. All right. Yeah. Who would do that, though? Who's incentivized to create this magical UI toolkit that would be able to use Swift on GT? Like, who's going to do that? Nobody. And I can't. Because I've had the same thought. It seems obvious, right? But the issue is, I can't think of anybody except for Apple, and Apple doesn't care about Linux apps. There's nobody that has any interest in that.
I would caution that. I mean, who gave a crap about running .NET on Linux years ago, right? In terms of mono.
Okay.
Think someone's going to do. Oh, by the way, there was a thing that used to be called OpenStep, or GNUStep, rather.
All right. Okay. Yeah. All right. Point well made. You got me there. That there is probably somebody, and they just because they can.
Just because they can, and because you know who you really don't write your GUI apps in Python.
Yeah. Well, that's still going to happen. Or Lua. Hello.
Lua's okay.
Yeah. I would actually like to see it too. I mean, Scrazer in the chat room, and I'm just being kind of like a bit of a troll because I actually would like to see it as well. You know, if it's gonna be out there and people are gonna be writing it, I want those applications available on Linux just as much as any other platform. So I'd like to see it. So how for you personally is it gonna be big? Are you gonna start? So because of this, are you just gonna start making Swift a priority when you're doing iOS applications? Like, how does this affect you personally?
Yeah, we already have, actually. So anything greenfield that's native iOS only is Swift. That's it. Anything cross is usually Xamarin. I mean, not Xamarin. It's definitely not Xamarin. I'll tell you that. It's Ionic. And Android is still Android, right? So it's Java.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's no file new Objective-C projects happening, and they haven't been happening for a while.
Okay. Speaking of Android, you tweeted, what was it, the 30th? Google confirms next Android version won't implement Oracle's proprietary Java API switching to OpenJDK. Any kind of like off-the-cuff impressions or thoughts about this? Does it, to you, imply that Oracle kind of has won?
It just seems like a great way to avoid a lawsuit again, right?
Well, for sure.
Right.
I think what's interesting about this news story is it came as a code dump initially. Somebody noticed a big code dump, posted on Hacker News, and then people started poking through, and they're like, this has got to be a sign that Google's kind of throwing in the hat on the Oracle lawsuit.
Why keep fighting?
Yeah.
It does scare me for one other reason, though.
Oh?
I have this sick suspicion that Google's going to come out with some alternative to Java for Android fairly soon.
Well, a lot of people have been saying it. I mean, why not have it with Dart or Go? I mean, you know, whatever. I don't know. I mean, let's have fun here and do something new.
Is anybody still using Dart?
Well, I think Google does somewhere. I don't know.
I mean, because you know, Google is the creator of AngularJS, and they don't seem. I mean, it
what
works.
About Go? What do you think? You know, what if?
I think Go is solving a different problem, right? Go yeah. is. Speed on the server.
Come
I don't
on, man.
Go...
Like, can a guy dream, though? Like, what are they going to do? Use Swift?
Oh, now wouldn't that be a kick in the face? They would not use Swift.
They do a fork. They do a fork. That's what they would do.
No, I would say Dart, but I kind of feel like they took Dart, buried it in the desert somewhere, and were like, sorry.
Yeah. Well, Micah68 in the chat rooms, he's researching Dart for a personal project.
Don't. Just
wow.
Don't.
Well, let us know what you think. Go to jupiterbroadcasting.com/contact or coderadio.reddit.com.
Same goes for TypeScript.
Which is where Chaotic Linux went. He went to coderadio.reddit.com, and he submitted programming books from Santa. And he has a massive link dump here. And you don't have to be a Reddit user, or you don't have to know anything about Reddit. If you just listen to this show and don't ever use Reddit, you can still follow this link because it's just a list of links, guys. Raspberry Pi user guides on there. Learn OpenGL, learn Ruby on Rails, Ruby tutorial, fundamentals of Python programming. This is really a great list. The Linux command line, the Linux development platform, the black art of programming, why Rust? Hey, there you go, Rust, guys. So that's a great list. So big thank you to Chaotic Linux who posted that a few days ago, and it just kind of caught my attention. And I wanted to give it a shout-out because I think that's a nice amount of effort he went to post that there, and that's a great resource for the Coda Radio audience. If there's a topic you wanted to hear discussed on the show, you could also submit it to codaradio.reddit.com. Mr. Dominic, is there any other business you want to attend to before we get out of here this week?
No, I would just say, Chris, again, I love you, man.
I love you, Mike.
I love you, man.
Happy 2016.
Oh, my God, it's a new year.
And don't forget, we're going to have something fun coming up later on in the month when we got a special guest host in, and you can support our efforts at teespring.com/last400. Go check out Mike over at Buccaneer.io. We got a link to his 2015 in review, a much expanded blog post over there, more than we talked about in today's episode. You can also find him on Twitter and me. We got links to that. And we also appreciate you joining us live over at jblive.tv, Mondays, noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern. All right, everybody, thanks so much for tuning in this week. See you right back here next week.